This episode of AVXL is recorded on May 31st, 2018. We're going to talk about, problems with Samsung's flagship LCD TV, new TV tech like Quantum Dot on glass, Vizio's P-Series Quantum and its amazing color, Neurophone's headphone using otoacoustic emissions to customize itself to your ears, Blue Wave's Get, help selling your AV gear, and so much more. Welcome to another fine, blended episode of AVXL.
Testing, 1, 2, 3. All right. I'm not blowing anything out.
Ignorant weasels chewing on your soul. Ignorant weasels. Do you have speed?
Yeah.
Welcome to AVXL, your guide to the best in home video and audio gear, no matter what your budget is. I'm Patrick Norton.
Hey, I am Robert Heron.
He is. I can see him.
I am good.
I assume you're Robert Heron. I've never actually seen your ID, but they hired you at ZDTV. Or Tech TV.
True.
So I assume they checked your documentation at that point.
True. They ran some background checks.
You could be living a lie.
I had to get through Mr. Kaiser back in the day.
Andrew.
He gave me the nod. He liked what he saw.
Beautiful human being.
Actually, I think, honest to God, what got me hired at Tech TV was a website I had created related to the original Quake world, where Quake became a 3D game.
Right.
And a buddy of mine was good at creating configuration files to optimize game performance back on the, you know, the relatively pathetic computers we had back then. But hey, that's what we had.
They were glorious at the time.
And in order to get an acceptable frame rate out of those games at the time, he came up with ways of minimizing details and other tweaks and tricks and things like that. And he was actually really good at making those files. I simply created a website that made it easy to find those files, and then the rest is history.
And then I stole you for the lab.
And then 3D acceleration just became the thing, and it's everywhere now, and it's good. So
this, by the way, is AVXL. We talk about home theater and audio gear and trying to get the best experience. Doesn't matter what your budget is.
Heck
and
yeah.
I will flat out say sometimes the expensive things don't give the best experience.
No. Not always.
Not always. But sometimes
they can be delightful.
Pretty freaking amazing. I'm going to read your title for the opening conversation in today's episode.
Okay.
Holy crap! A justifiably critical review of Samsung's flagship LCD TV. Now, is this the television where people were being advised to I won't call it percussive maintenance, although technically it is a subset of percussive maintenance.
This is not that.
Okay, this was
the 7 series, I believe, from last year. That's still widely available. The new 7 series, I'm hoping, has different issues. or not that issue, where in that particular case, what we're talking about was that light guide plates could be within the TV, the LCD structure itself, could have been shifted due to shipping snafus or improper shipping and handling.
Tell me, with this highly sophisticated piece of electronics and visual display technology, how does one realign the panels? A particularly expensive tool?
I would return it and exchange it for a brand new one from a different company.
But Samsung
what they showed was placing that poor TV back in the box securely within the original container and then dropping it a few times from a couple feet off the ground. And it jiggled things around enough to where it did, in measurement, improve what was happening in terms of the light output.
I have a name for this. Gravitational impact alignment, which is, I think, a subcategory of percussive maintenance.
This was related to measuring light output on some of the latest TVs. And that is a continuing issue I'm seeing, not due to damage or alignment or things like that. But I think that a lot of reviewers using older gear are coming into displays that their gear can no longer handle the light output, the excessive light output. Right. Excessive. It can never be enough. But in terms of very bright TVs, distorting the readings or being inaccurate in terms of what's happening, or missing a certain setting within the TV in order to get whatever that peak luminance output should be, you know, according to the spec of the manufacturer. So, mean just like little mistakes, or not little mistakes, but a little differences in measurement according to what the manufacturer says should be there versus what the reviewer is saying. These can be like a third of what it should be. And these things need to be worked out. And actually, I'm helping out someone this week related to that very issue. So I'll be, and I won't even say who the manufacturer is until I take a look at this, because it could be an error between the keyboard and chair. There's always that possibility. And I myself have succumbed to that once in a while. So
my goodness.
I'm down with that. But speaking of critical reviews of TVs, I have to say, I really enjoy watching Vincent Tio's YouTube channel for the hdtvtest.co.uk group. Vincent's a good calibrator, and he makes good deals to get a hold of gear in a timely manner. And this time around, it was Samsung's flagship QLED series, the Q9FN, the latest one. It has impressed many reviewers. If you go out and read the reviews of this online, generally very positive. One of the absolute brightest TVs you can buy today. Superb color. However, when he measured its HDR setup, in particular, something called how it tracks the brightness output, and that's called its EOTF, the electro-optical transfer function, where the signal is being transferred into the light you see. Within HDR, it is specified of how much light should be coming off that screen, and the TV will make its own assessment as to what its capabilities are and map that accordingly in a in a technology we generally term tone mapping. In this case, with the flagship Samsung TV, with 1000 nit mastered content, it was simply making it too bright. It was washing out detail that it makes for a brighter picture that perhaps would grab your attention a little bit more, but in terms of accurately representing the author's intent or the content creator's intent, it was not the case. It was a little too crazy in terms of what it's doing. Clearly an error, and it was visible within the measurements. There is no easy fix for it, because if you try to adjust that, your content that's mastered at other nit levels, like the most popular currently, when they author this content, they're either authoring it for something around 600 nits or around 1,000 nits or at 4,000 nits. Those generally correspond to the most popular mastering displays that are out there,
right,
be it an OLED, a very good OLED, and then these things called pulsar displays from Dolby that can actually dump 4,000 nits of light output. And these are the panels that people are looking at when they create the content. So that number, in terms of its mastering level of the light output of that display, is actually coded into the material you're looking at. There are plenty of movies out there that are mastered to 4,000 nits or 1,000 nits or 600 nits. And it just seemed like no matter what you did on this TV, it was just simply expressing, especially in the mid-range, too bright of a picture, washing out that detail. There were other issues with the TV as well that he pointed out, and I think one of the most obvious ones was how aggressive its local dimming was. When viewed straight on, this TV is the closest thing you're going to see to OLED-like performance in terms of black level. In terms of achieving that black level, though, when you looked at film content, particularly the big example was using something like a space scene with lots of stars in the background. Sure. There was significant vignetting where the border of the picture was darkened compared to the middle when you had it side by side with other very capable HDR TVs. There's clearly some software that needs to be tweaked a little bit within the Q9FN. Vincent's review, I thought, was straight on, and I'm sure he caught a lot of crap from a lot of people and manufacturers related to that. You put out a critical piece like that against a flagship product, everything you did and said is going to be gone through with a fine-tooth comb. And so far, it's holding up quite nicely. One thing he did do, though, is point out other reviewers who had this TV, had obtained the same measurements he did, yet didn't call them out on it. That's something where, to me, I was kind of like, oh, I had a moment where I just sort of stepped back and said, you know, there is a time where you do have to trust your measurement tools, the software you're using, and what the industry specs are. And when things do look odd, say so, even if you don't fully understand why, but at least say so, and then investigate further. I think it adds to the compelling nature of what it is you're trying to say, and it gives you some, like, hey, you're a human being. You might not fully grok what the hell is going on with this particular TV at this moment, but there is something odd there that needs to be said. So learn to use your tools properly. I'm not saying people don't know how to use their tools, but if you do see the odd result, retest a few times, check with others, and see what's going on. And push it forward. Needless to say, I'm looking forward to software updates for the Samsung flagship TV. I haven't heard this issue with any of the other models that are out there now. The Q9FN is unique in the sense that it is a full array local dimming TV. Even with that issue, I would still consider it the very best LCD you can buy today, short of the Z9D from Sony that has been out for a couple of years, but still remains one of the very best TVs ever made as far as LCDs go. I had a chance to calibrate one of those a couple weeks ago. It's still a fond memory, I must say. It turns out, according to an article over at Forbes, that Sony accidentally hinted that new models will be coming out later this year. Well, it's apparently a mistake on a Sony US website that confirmed that Sony does have at least a couple of new premium models coming out later this year. And the one that stuck out to me was a new model for that Z9, mm-hmm. and it's going to be the Z9F in 65 and 75 inch screen sizes, as well as a new premium OLED that has yet to be revealed. So if this accidental leak turns out to be true, Sony's got some sweet new gear coming out before the end of the year. That, to me, is just excitement.
A little bit of tasty and delicious.
Exactly. Their CES presence had a lot of great stuff in that booth, but it wasn't really anything display-wise that was mind-blowing, that wasn't a prototype.
Right.
So these are their ultra-premium OLED mm-hmm. for 2018 and a successor to the Z9D, now to be the Z9F. That would be the big deal. So... let's hope they get that out and soon.
That
because
would be nice.
Given what they were showing off at CES, considering that 10,000 nit prototype and the new 8K upscaler technology and their extreme ultimate whatever hell processor right. that was, this could just be the flagship TV to go for 2018, if you can hold out.
Hold out for it, people. Just wait to see. For everybody who has a HomePod, get excited. AirPlay 2 is coming with iOS 11.4. That's bringing stereo pairs and multi-room audio. And I think that's wonderful.
Nice.
Because it now means a HomePod has some of the same awesome functionality as Sonos devices that cost considerably less. I will say I've had some chances to hear the HomePod in the Apple store and at a friend's house. And I do enjoy the sound. I am really much more excited now that they're doing a stereo, the ability to do stereo, because the Sonos, Play Ones really taught me that as much as I like single source audio, because, a Play 3 or Play 5 in the kitchen is fantastic, a pair of Play Ones, stereo is much more awesome. But yeah, I'm excited, right? Free software updates will allow you to, turn on audio in all the rooms in your house that have a HomePod, or turn on HomePods, play audio, whole house streaming.
Totally.
Like, I don't know how to say it. You click like kitchen, living room, doghouse, bathroom, and all of a sudden music's playing everywhere.
With like the Sonos One, yeah. Their first Alexa-enabled speaker as well. Mm-hmm. So if you wanted a smart speaker with Alexa... you have that option.
I don't know if a
premium speaker, I would say, for about the same amount of money.
Actually,
$199 in black or white.
I don't know if I want Alexa built into my speakers yet. There's no reason not to have it, unless you don't use Alexa and you use Google Home or you want to use
Siri.
It's interesting. Mary Meeker's big sort of the state of the internet report came out, and she said Alexa has gone from 20 to 30 million homes in the U.S., which means it's in approximately, sit down, this is going to be intense, one in every four household. If there's 128 million households in the U.S., it's almost, almost one in four has an Amazon Alexa product in it.
I think also it will be that folks will have devices in their home that they didn't even realize were enabled.
A lot
of new TVs are incorporating that functionality. A lot of home theater products. A lot of smart speakers.
I got to ask, if you're using Alexa or Google Home, and I'm sorry, I've said Alexa like six times in the last 2 minutes. If you're using, an Amazon Echo device or a compatible device like the Eufy, if you're using Google Home, if you're using Siri, let us know what you're using it to control. Are you using it to control your home theater, your audio? Is it controlling everything in your house? Do you need to send us an email to send an extraction team because your smart locks won't unlock because you've upset Alexa or Siri or the home? Let us know. I thought that was interesting, finally, that something I think it should have been shipped with is out on the HomePod. And,
oh, heck yeah.
So
update your mobile device, update your AirPlay.
Go buy a second HomePod.
Update your HomePod with AirPlay 2 and live good.
You were down at Sid's Display Week last week.
Yeah, in Los Angeles. That was fantastic. A small show, the Society of Information Displays Display mm-hmm. Week Conference. It's effectively where the manufacturers get together, and everybody who has a component that goes into a display system is there. Not a big show by any means, and it's definitely way more technical in terms of, you're not going to see washers and dryers just sitting around there.
Right.
But if you're into test equipment and how displays are manufactured and what it is that they're proudly working on currently.
It's glorious.
It really was. I have to say, it was pretty cool.
You rarely glow when you're talking over the phone, but you were glowing.
I had no expectations for this show. And I will say, this was at the LA Convention Center, and I walked into the wrong end of the convention center. And I would say more than, I'd say about three quarters of this facility was currently being used for naturalization, where everyone who was about to become a U.S. citizen and take the final pledge or whatever it is you do, there must have been 25, 30,000 people there, all right, dressed to the T and excited as could be. So there was a crazy energy going on there. I'm making my way through that, trying to get over to my little corner where where the manufacturers are. And there was a lot of good things to check out there as well. Right off the bat, one of the first booths I encountered was the Nanosys Group. And they were showing off, in partnership with some of their friends, quantum dot on glass. And you could basically think of this as saying goodbye to the thick plastic light guide plates. We were talking about those and how they could be bounced back into alignment properly. Well, generally, those plastic pieces that distribute the light behind a screen evenly. Right. Say, if you're doing an edge lit display, these LEDs would be pointed into the edge of this plastic, and that plastic would help distribute evenly across the display the light that will then shine forward through and out the pixels. Mm-hmm. And in this case, they're working on a glass structure that would replace that, making it much thinner, and the ability then to print the quantum dot material directly onto that glass structure.
That's pretty cool.
So the main thing is improved rigidity and the ability to then have one less piece in the stack rather than having a separate layer that replaces a diffusion layer, say, with something impregnated with quantum dot materials. This allows them to then print directly onto the light guide plate the red and green quantum dot materials, still using that blue backlight system. And in Samsung's booth, they had a demo of a 65-inch 8K screen using this QD glass, they call it. Actually, I got to say, Nanosys has a cute name for this called Q-Dog, quantum dot on glass. And I just have to get that out there. That was pretty damn clever, I have to say. So anyway.
You enjoy that.
So yeah, the same blue backlight system, red and green printed, literally liquid printed right onto the surface of the glass light guide plate. This particular display was about 500 nits and about 95% of DCI. And my first question was, well, since you don't have the quantum dot material encapsulated within like a couple layers of relatively tough plastic,
right,
how are you protecting them? And they're saying, oh, we simply clear coat the glass once we apply the quantum dot materials to that. In addition to eliminating another diffuser layer sheet, making a thinner, more rigid display, the next step for a lot of manufacturers on the LCD side in terms of how are we going to deliver more light to the eyeballs of our owners.
Right.
And particularly with glass, you think about the heat that comes off an LED, mm-hmm, and glass would be able to handle that heat much easier.
Yeah.
So that's another advantage of having a glass instead of plastic light guide plate. Also at this show, there were various AR and VR display-related techs. They had some smartphone-sized displays doing crazy depth cue stuff in different ways. Lots of glasses-free 3D visualization. It was kind of neat. Some of it, actually, was like where you could lean your head left and right and look around the object on a display. Like, it was really kind of hanging there in 3D space. You could see this coming. There were some limitations to it in the sense that, sure, this display could only be a 3D display. It couldn't go back and do an effective 2D. So while it was a very interesting prototype, it had some limitations in terms of, you know, would you want this in a phone? Well, not if it can't be a good 2D display too, but when they can actually switch back and forth, it should be pretty fantastic. In the Samsung booth, they had two different displays side by side doing similar things in different ways, but they were effectively breaking a very high resolution image up to 39 unique views over a 28 degree viewing angle. And they called it, oh, let me read this, binocular disparity vergence motion parallax. And Google that. It's just like one of those old school cardboard plastic things you could look at and tilt and get a different view of an object. Well, this was just the digital version of that. And it was very effective in terms of being able to really look at a 3D object on a flat screen. Right next door to that was the craziest, most detailed display I've seen in terms of what could eventually go into a VR headset. 1,443 dots per inch on a single eyeball. And
whoa,
that was really, really detailed. This was in the LG booth and in partnership with...
Sorry, that seems a little... That does sound really, really detailed.
It was really, really nice. And I had a chance to put my eyeball on that, and they had it side by side with an imaging system that had the current state-of-the-art tech in it. So in the current tech, you can see the pixels if you have decent vision.
Right.
Clearly visible. But when you moved up to this 1,443 DPI LG/Google partnership display, it was very detailed.
I'm laughing because that is a higher density. It's just that the density on that is so insane compared to what's currently being put in VR headsets.
And this was effectively a 144 hertz display, I want to say, or at least 120, had a DCI color coverage, and that seamlessness of not really noticing pixels, and to be able to look at detailed imagery. Although they weren't showing anything in motion, it was right. A series of static images, but the detail within these static scenes was fantastic. And they were doing close-ups of everything from nature scenes to currency and other things that just had maps that had very fine detail where you could zoom in and really, you know, it didn't matter that it was a couple inches from your eyeball. You were still perceiving very seamless detail. And that was super cool. Something a little more realistic and closer to home, at least currently, there's these new 144 hertz HDR 1000 displays going out, or at least being announced right now from a couple of companies. And AUO is there showing off a very nice 4K 27-inch monitor. 144 hertz refresh rate, display HDR 1000, which is the, I want to say, the Visa spec for PC HDR monitors. Now, the interesting thing about the 1000 level of HDR, or display HDR, is that it's not 1000 nits of light output for minutes on end, it's peak brightness. And then typically you're going to get about 600 nits consistently out of this display. Quantum dot color. This particular monitor had NVIDIA's G-Sync built right in. It had a pretty impressive, what they called a mini LED backlight system with very many zones. I'd be curious to know exactly how many. They weren't going into that in too much detail, but the local dimming capabilities of that 27-inch monitor looked fantastic. It was truly a glorious-looking LCD, and considering what like Asus and a couple other companies are doing with... I'm willing to bet they're using this AUO panel, so... It'll be just a... I just can't wait for the prices to come down from like the current $2,000 for these kind of displays. But soon. Soon. And right next door, Japan Display Incorporated was showing off a 17.3-inch display, 8K LCD on a small, like a large notebook-sized panel, being backlit with lasers, providing 97% of BT2020. So that is a huge color palette. And super saturated. That was more of a science-y project. Right nearby that, in the Nanosys booth, was a couple of TVs from their partners who are using quantum dots in their designs. And one of them happened to be the Vizio P-Series Quantum, the 2018. It's not even out in the stores yet. This is perhaps the best color saturation I've seen on any 2018 TV. Granted, this was a demo. They were literally handed an open box product from Vizio just to have this display in their booth. And... They made a point. It's like, Robert, don't measure that. You're not allowed to measure that one. Just wait till the final box unit comes out. Leave that one alone. One of the interesting things about the Vizio P series is that its type of quantum dot that they're using within that is a variation on like one of three popular formulas right now. This one produces some of the best color saturation of any of the TV manufacturers out there right now. So if they're able to control this color rendering and quality as good as it looked, this should be just a fantastic value. They're saying $2,000 for 65-inch, best-in-class picture quality. Just subjectively, looking at a display on a wall running what was Netflix looping demos that were actually built into the TV, which was kind of odd. It looked freaking fantastic, and it had effective local dimming and just some of the very best color I've seen. I just simply want to know when the release date is for that sucker.
This sounds like a television you are officially lusting after.
The performance, the color performance alone. And granted, we're talking like a percentage, like a TV that can do like, say, 97% of DCI versus 98%.
Right.
That's kind of subtle. Level. But to get there, one of the interesting things I learned was that some manufacturers are using quantum dot materials that eliminate cadmium as a toxic metal. It's like, oh, okay, we're going to go cadmium free.
Right.
However, that makes it harder to do exquisite saturated color. It's easier to do it when you have cadmium in the mix because the particles are easier to size appropriately. Let's just say that toxic metals can make for very colorful TVs. I just want to I'll leave it at that. So anyway.
Well, they also make for really good batteries.
That too.
Well, that was one of the big stories this week that I want to say Panasonic, who makes batteries for Tesla
and
a billion other places. Because cadmium is essentially single source from one place in the world, they are working to completely eliminate cadmium from their battery formulas.
There's a few rare metals that are definitely being phased out. Also, at Display Week 2018 were lots of demos related to the manufacturing or automotive or you name it. There was lots of technical demos about not necessarily a shipping product, but things that could be incorporated into a shipping product. One company called Tianma had some of the coolest OLED demos on the whole show floor. Do you want to see a bending mobile OLED display? I mean, like paper thin and bending it like flat against each other.
Sure.
They had that. You want to see a bending mobile display with a strain gauge built in that was acting like a protractor with a digital display on it? They had that too. They talk about flexible displays and bending displays. Right. This was one where who can have the craziest bendy display demo on the show floor? They had one that was so thin and paper-like that they had a fan under it. It was kind of just blowing in the breeze and flapping along. Terrific looking stuff. And I'll say the best, I would say the most eye-grabbing thing I saw at the whole show was from a company called ASK A3D. And they were showing off what effectively looked like holographic, like straight out of the original Star Wars with Princess Leia being projected out of R2-D2 into space in front of you. This was the craziest thing I've seen in a long time. This particular demo utilized an 8-inch display. The resolution of the output is kind of low, relatively speaking, but it literally floats in front of your vision like it is sitting there without special glasses, no perfect vision or something like that. It does use a specialized glass plate that sits between whatever the display is that's to be projected into space, or if it could be an object or whatever. And this special plate has very, very finely spaced mirrors that can effectively digitize, quote unquote, whatever that object is placed on the other side. And then through their technical prowess, they're able to then to recreate on the exact other side of that display that object literally hanging in the air. And in this case, for the demo they were showing, it was that 8-inch display with an IR tracking system for fingers and things like that. So they had a virtual remote just literally sitting there. And I thought it was an actual object. So I go up and touch it and my fingers go right through it. But whoa. I was activating the buttons and everything like that as if it were really there.
That's pretty space age.
It was good enough to fool me just walking by it. And I was like, I had to stand there for a few minutes and take a good look at that. You can check out the website at askA3D.com and look at what they're doing. I don't know how practical that would be for what the usage application is in the end, but in terms of convincing me that there was an object floating there and I kept trying to touch it, it
worked. Remote controls and adventure parks.
It worked really well.
No buttons to break. Just hopefully children won't punch it.
I could even think of like maybe a flusher on a public restroom or something like that, where you don't have to actually touch anything. That might be a little overkill. That was probably I don't know what this technology
costs. Trying not to say out loud, we so basic.
Let's start with that.
How earthy. We got a couple of viewer questions coming up. Ask@avxl.com is the place to reach us, or you can tweet @avxl, @PatrickNorton, or @RobertHeron. And I want to remind everybody, we really appreciate all of you that contribute via patreon.com/avxl. That's how we get paid. We're running ad-free right now. We could run ads, but we don't want to because we don't want to.
No, and we recently had a really cool hangout with some of our patrons, and I have to say that was fantastic. Actually, that was when I was down in LA. I was coming back. I was sitting at the airport, ping me on hangout, and boom, here we are chatting it up with people from all over the world.
It seems like we want to get more of you involved in the hangout. Would it be easier if we did a hangout like on the third Thursday of every month or the second Wednesday? Let us know. We'll pick one. We'll try
weekend.
That out.
I'm not
or
sure.
Weekend. Should we try weekends?
Do
weekends work for you?
Yeah.
Email ask@avxl.com. Let us know. Do you have time on the weekend? I know it's hard. You got your shit full of two.
I did.
Your Sony MDR7506s.
Yeah.
How are you liking the full of two?
Good Lord. I think that's just a fantastic product. It gave me exactly what I want. I truly appreciate just having an analog quality feeling knob to adjust my volume with.
That's an Alps RK09 potentiometer.
It is part of my workstation now, and it will not leave. The setup is simple. You just plug the damn thing in. If the tech says I'm full of shit, which I think is the funniest thing in the world. So every time I pull up an audio device or whatever, it's like, what device would you like? Oh, I want the I'm full of shit. And I think it's just it's a cute thing that makes me smile all the time. The sound quality is fantastic.
Yeah.
And
it's a nice DAC. It's an AKM AK4490. Filter stages are TI OPA 1662s. They're using TI amps, and the TI amps are really good.
There ain't nothing wrong with it. Plenty of volume output. Mm-hmm. You can blow your ears off if you know, especially with those Sony headphones. I find those Sony headphones are excellent in terms of isolation, mm-hmm. in terms of just hearing fine detail about everything. I will say my value gaming headphones rather muddy up the listening experience comparatively.
The trick to being happy with your headphones is to never listen to any other headphones, which is why I am so hosed.
And those aren't that expensive. They were like $80, 70, yeah. $80 for those Sonys. Pair that with the Full of Two, and I'm a happy, happy camper right now.
It's a nice piece. It's like, what, $99?
It's great for editing, mm-hmm. audio. It's great for gaming. The only thing I don't have with it is microphone support, but right. Oh, boohoo. I'll plug in my gaming headphones when I absolutely have to talk to somebody over the internets, but...
You can always cable something to the microphone input on the sound card or something, because you can split the signals on those. One of the things I like about shit is they don't really buy into a lot of the flavor of the month audio formats. They do some of the more high-end stuff. This is everything you need for quality stereo audio. It's like 1644-1, 2496, which is essentially UAC-1, basic USB audio. That'll run on Windows, Mac, Linux, Android. I haven't tried it with iOS yet. Total harmonic distortion, less than 0.008%, 20 hertz to 20,000 hertz at 1 volt RMS. Signal noise ratio is like greater than 102 decibels, which should be considerably higher than the human ear can actually detect.
Every time someone comes over, I do try to get them to listen to like a favorite song or something. And just to... Yeah, I'm ruining people left and right. It's like, good. And now everything else you've heard sucks.
You have joined my mission. Oh, my goodness.
But I'm currently tearing through Far Cry 5 with that pair of headphones, and that makes it fun, man. I'm thoroughly enjoying it.
Good. I was worried they would get it and be like, you fool, Norton.
No.
How dare you?
I think that's the baseline for a lot of people. Anybody interested in headphones, you can't go wrong with that package. You're well under $200 for the amp plus headphones. Mm-hmm. And hey, you can always spend more. So
you can return them to Amazon and go find something fancier. And we'll help you with that too. Luxury headphones. So I gotta say, I am embracing wireless audio.
Excellent.
Weird. Well, I should say wireless headphones.
I embrace Bluetooth in convenience modes. Yeah. Like, I want to be private when I'm watching my TV and not disturb the people in the house. So I'll put on my Bluetooth headphones and link them to the TV.
Oh, my goodness.
But I'm not, for critical listening, I'm usually on a wired setup. Yeah. But the convenience factor is strong.
If I want the ultimate, I probably want a cable. But part of my sort of conversion of this, let me throw this at you really quickly. This is the Blue Wave Get. And I saw that for the first time at CanJam SoCal last year. They actually had them up for sale. They're for sale right now. BlueWaveAudio.ca. They're a Canadian company. Really nice people.
It's about the size of a Zippo.
Smaller. It's tiny, right? It's you see the clip?
Very lightweight.
So that is a clip-on wireless DAC and amp and microphone. Does Bluetooth 5.0, which is backwards compatible with older forms of Bluetooth, AAC for iOS, aptX HD, weighs less than 30 grams. The volume control on that is an ALPS potentiometer. This is ALPS potentiometer week on AVXL.
Very cool.
And then it's got a full set of buttons for play, pause, answer, and skip. My mom actually was pretty impressed by the microphone, which if you've ever had a conversation with my mom, is a big deal.
So you could use this to make your favorite pair of headphones Bluetooth.
Bingo.
That is...
Bluetooth or aptX or aptX HD.
And this is not a giant product that's bulky or anything. You just clip it to your shirt pocket or, heck, to your jacket or whatever.
And if you're gorgeous. Driving a giant... Yeah, the construction I was really impressed by. You can, for $15, you can buy a kit that has a bigger clip and like a 2.5 millimeter or 3.5 millimeter short cable. So you can literally... You know, clip that to the headband on your existing headphones, your favorite headphones. That kit costs $15. The Blue Wave Get costs $129. I think it showed up on Mass Drop for $99. Figure 6 hours if you turn it up all the way and you've got some massive, like basically if you want to.
That was
my
first concern with something that svelte. Well, how much battery are they shoving in there?
Well, here's the thing. Like, you know, they say like
6 hours.
Okay.
But I think that's if you have it turned up to 100% because you're trying to drive massive planar magnetics. At normal human, not trying to ruin your hearing levels. You know, I was using it for commuting around the house and the office. I went several days without charging with no issues.
Very cool.
You know, micro USB cable for recharging. You can use the Get while it's recharging, which I really appreciate. I think it's as flawless as wireless audio gets. It's $130.
I was going to say, with aptX HD, which I'm not even aware of exactly what that brings over aptX, but...
Better.
Yes. they have also, like, I'm surprised now. They are doing lossless audio over Bluetooth now.
Yeah.
If you have the both ends of the chain are supporting that function, so...
It's interesting.
Bluetooth has grown up quite a bit in the last 5 years.
Well, it's not like I listen to Bluetooth now and I'm like, this is missing. Like,
right.
You know, when I'm...
Unacceptable.
Yeah. And I will say I was kind of amazed at how much I enjoyed not having cables attaching my head to my phone, which brings us to a tweet. And where is that tweet? There it is. Ben, a.k.a. at Hardy_BM, tweeted out, "What do you guys think of the Neurophone? They're heavily promoted on social media. I'm attracted by the otoacoustic trickery, but I'm not sure how much of it is woo," which is probably my favorite word right now.
Woo.
"Your advice is appreciated." So I ended up reaching out to the Neurophone crew, Neurosound, at Neurosound on Twitter. They sent a unit for testing. It is really interesting because I will say from a pure like, you know, fantastic aesthetics on the websites and big sciency words, there's a lot of woo on that website.
Okay.
I found the headphones to be refreshingly woo-free.
Good.
So the core of this is A, the Neurophone itself, and B, the application that runs on your phone. So otoacoustic emissions, I'll just read. This is a lovely.
What was that word?
otoacoustic emissions.
Awesome.
So if you go to the lovely Audiology Online website, you'll find out that, quote, "An otoacoustic emission is a low-level sound emitted by the cochlea, either spontaneously or evoked by an auditory stimulus." And what happens is essentially you download the app, you connect the phone, or you connect the Neurophones, these wireless headphones,
okay,
which are, you know, aptX and aptX HD, and I want to say Bluetooth 4.0. You connect them to your phone, you run the application. And what the application does is first it makes sure that the outer cups seal over your ear properly, because that's really critical. Then it runs a test. The test runs a whole bunch of tones into your ears, and there's microphones built into those that listen for those tiny, tiny otoacoustic emissions. It then creates a custom sound profile, what they call sonic molding, trademark, for your left and right ears, because oftentimes your left and right ears differ. And then it creates this sort of Rorschach blotch, your unique hearing profile, and it adapts the sound system on that to, quote, match your hearing system. And, you know, there's part of me that I got to say I was really impressed. Like, A, they are testing something because...
These look futuristic. The Neuro headphones do. They literally look like in-ear earphones built into the cans of a pair of headphones. So
they literally are.
These are very unique looking, and I can see where just that description of what the technology is behind it. So, there could be a lot of processing that goes into customizing the output of these to a specific person. And
they call it
freaking neat.
So that's their Innova architecture. I'm going to use all the marketing terms.
They feel quality as well.
They feel. So the ear pads are silicone.
Right.
They ventilate using Tesla valves.
Excellent.
Before I can say Tesla, the happier I am. Like, Tesla valves are essentially one-way fluid valves.
Right.
And the idea is that air comes in at the bottom, out at the top. And I bring that up because I was, you know, I had silicone strapped over my ears on an 80-degree day and my ears didn't sweat. So maybe I was dehydrated or maybe the cooling works. But yeah, there's this in-ear stalk that sticks itself into your ear hole.
You aren't just throwing these on your head. You're getting them into your...
You're placing them. You're seating them. Like putting on a baseball glove, you know? And that goes into your ear. There's a full range driver behind that. And then inside the ear cup, there is a bass driver. And you can tune the bass outputs. They call it immersion mode. I say it's a loudness slider.
But still.
And the higher you turn up, the more bass you get, because they've essentially separated that chunk of frequency, or they're augmenting that chunk of frequency with a secondary driver.
I'm a fan of anything that can give the individual listener a hearing test,
yeah,
per se, and help customize that output, not only for you personally, but for each ear.
Yeah, it's cool. The profile is stored on the headphone, so once the app is run, you're good to go. And then you can store up to three unique profiles, which you basically have to switch through on the app. But it gives you this Rorschach blotch kind of look of what your sound is. And the farther away it is from the center of that circle, the more sensitive you are to that particular frequency range. And they have this cool thing on the website where it unrolls it to low frequency and high frequency, which makes it easier to look at. But
you can see how unique your input is.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure
your reception of the signal.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty sure it's working. And I got to say, it sounded fantastic. Big soundstage.
Good.
Right? Because I always get nervous about multiple driver headphones because it's non-trivial to make them work. But big sound stage, lots of good crisp highs, really excellent sort of decay and feel to the cymbals and stuff like that. A lot of thud. One of the things they said is by putting this headphone over your earlobe gets hit with a lot of the bass in a way that, and the skin around your ear, they feel that makes it, you because of the way you hear, you get a better feel or immersive feel for the bass. I put it up to about 40 or 50%. And, you know, that made my clutch stuff have impact. Not quite like, you know, I was standing next to the drum kit because, you know, I would feel the kick drum through my entire body, but right. It gave me a good feel of that bass heading into my skull. They sound really good. They awesome. Sound really, really good. They're $400.
They look like it though. They don't they don't look cheap. And they feel awesome.
Feel,
in the
materials
hand.
Feel fantastic. I mean, yes. They look good.
The wireless design.
Yeah, I was fully prepared.
The ability to store some custom presets right into the ear or the headphone mm-hmm. itself. I keep wanting to call them earphones because they kind of have earphones
well,
in the
earphones and headphones.
Yes, they are.
They do a really good job of
just very unique.
Yes. They are very unique, and they do a really good job of isolating you from noise. It's passive. It's not active.
Very cool.
But
my favorite kind.
Yeah. I mean, there's basically two layers between your ear and the outside. I was really impressed by them.
Yeah, beautiful build quality.
Yeah, I am.
They're fun to touch. And I'm sure they sound delightful.
They do sound delightful. We'll get you. We'll clean off the ear tips and fire them up for you. Comes with a USB charging cable. But I got kind of two concerns about them. One of which I didn't really pick up with until after I got Sennheiser's HD1 wireless in. One is there's no volume control on these, and it wasn't until I had the Sennheiser's that I realized how much I liked a volume control. Two.
Well, you have to whip out the app in order to.
Well, you have to use use the volume control on your phone.
Right.
Like instead of having a little, you know, slider or knob or clicker on the headphones.
Mm.
So you have two buttons, right? You know,
right.
You can sort of play, like the stock setup is to play, pause, or answer or hang up on a call with one button, you know, on the outside of the ear cup. And then the other one is, it's not even a button. It's more of a
like capacitive touch control.
Yeah, capacitive touch with a little haptic feedback. And the other one turns immersion on and off. But
okay.
Every time I turn immersion off, I go, where's the bass? And I tap it again. So I should probably, you know, change that to something else.
So
you
as can long use as it to skip forward. The source device is my phone. I tend to always keep a finger right on the volume rocker anyway.
Right.
And I'll just, yeah, I see what you say, though.
You know, so it's you know, it's because it's also because I go from a relatively quiet office to mildly loud streets to a very loud bus, and I usually manipulate my audio a little bit there, or because the tracks I'm listening to vary on their level. So I would like to have volume adjustment on that. You can only connect to a single Bluetooth device at a time. It can't connect to multiple Bluetooth devices. They expect a firmware fix for that later on. I was really impressed. I got to say, Ben, there are certain woo signs here, but the product delivers, and the build quality really is fantastic.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Watching you fondle them reminded me of that.
Mm. Yeah, they really do feel good in the hand.
Oh, my goodness. You do have to get used to having that thing sticking in your ear all the time, which sure. You will either forget about or, you know, won't. But if...
That is not optional.
It's not as invasive as a true earbud, I will say that.
True that.
I also got a chance. So Sennheiser was gracious enough to share a set of the HD1 wirelesses. Those are kind of the standard on lot of levels. They're based on the sort of the Momentum became the Momentum 2.0, or they evolved the Momentum into the Momentum 2.0 with a larger ear cup. And then at some point they did a branding shift in the last year or two, and the Momentum became the HD1 line. That's one of the best wireless headphones you can buy. Active noise cancellation built in, which you can't turn off, which is kind of a bummer. That said, unlike other active noise cancellation products I've tried, it doesn't ruin the music. It's not a horrible headphone. It's a great headphone. The active noise cancellation works. It wasn't until I took the headphones off that I was like, oh, the dryer's running, or oh my goodness, listen to that, you know.
Fan noise or that, yeah. Any repetitive droning sound is great for active noise cancellation.
You know, so, you know, it's good soundstage, not quite as huge as the Neurophone, but a good soundstage, good instrument location, classic Sennheiser sound, a little more neutral on the highs than the Neurophone, solid bass. I was missing the loudness. I was enjoying the volume control on the Sennheiser HD1, but missing the ability to turn the bass up
right,
like the Neurophone. They have a volume control and on-off button. They do AptX, not AptX HD, but that, you know, that said, there's a short list of items that do AptX HD currently. Figure something like 22 hours of battery life, figure 18 to 20 on the Neurophone. They have a 2-microphone beamforming array, which is excellent. I was using it in wind yesterday on a phone, and nobody was complaining.
Very nice.
Yeah, and the mic in the Neurophone is pretty solid too. Not quite as good, but still very usable. Another nice thing about those HD1 wireless from Sennheiser, just did a price drop on that. They're at $312 on Amazon. If you want to pick up the Neurophones, neurophone.com is the best place to go for that. And
would you think somebody considering something like Bose's Quiet Comfort or their noise active noise canceling headphones to consider something like Sennheiser for the HD1 if you just want to step up in audio quality?
Absolutely. I am not
during your travels. I always think of airplane flights whenever I think of noise canceling headphones, but
I did some
a passenger in just about any vehicle.
You know, I
can be useful.
I haven't heard the latest over ears from Bose. They may have gotten better. The in ears I have tested, they offer the most phenomenal, like, you know, we are ripping the volume control down on this big giant chunk of frequency. And they make flying much more pleasant.
Okay.
The audio quality on music was atrocious. The bass was bloated. It was overcompensated. They had kind of a weird V shape. The treble was crappy. And so audiobooks were great on it. Just sitting with the noise cancellation on and nothing playing was great on it. But with these in-ears from Bose I was using, music, I knew they sucked. I knew what the music sounds like. So to listen to music through those was more irritating than enjoyable.
I bring that up just because so many people I know that's just the brand they're aware of.
Yes.
And they don't think of anything else. And it's that's where I'm going first.
There's two things about Bose. They are an extraordinary marketing company.
Oh, yeah.
And number two, they offer a huge amount of attenuation for their active noise canceling. They just rip the noise out. They just make the noise go away.
That's what they're good at. That's what they're really good at.
I wish music sounded better on them. Again, I haven't heard the latest generation over ears. They may be better.
I'm a $2 earplug guy.
Yeah, I mean, one more has got an active noise canceling earbud that, you know, uses lightning. I liked those a lot. You know, I liked the passive audio blocking, or, you know, the insulation.
My old school Shures, man. I use foam earplug, replaceable, disposable earplug tips that are crazy good. And that's my go-to for passive noise cancellation. So.
Yeah.
I can practically sleep in those things.
I like the Neurophone. The Sennheiser's got some of the best active noise cancellation I've heard. You know, those were over $400 when they came out, and they're now selling for $312 on Amazon. I don't think you would be unhappy with any of these headphones.
Sounds good.
So it's something worth considering. Also a very different product from those Sonys we were talking about. You know, with the Sennheisers, I would probably... Because you can't turn off the active noise cancellation, if I was going to be doing some serious listening at my desk, I would probably want to be using a standard wired headphone. I wish they would give the ability to turn that off just to hear what they sound like, because I like the way Momentum sound.
Right.
Excuse me, HD.
It is an odd thing that it's on all the time.
But they may have just not had a switch for it.
True. This will ruin everything if we try to shove a switch in at this point. Stop. Just ship it.
Ship it.
Version HD2 coming soon.
Oh, my goodness. It's an interesting thought.
We got an email from Craig. He writes, Robert and Patrick, I tend to be overly detailed, so in an effort to keep this short, I'm asking for your help to sell the speakers for my surround sound system. It is a full clip system with the following components. The Klipsch RF5 with 8-inch Tractix horn tweeter and two 8-inch woofers, Cherry Finis, it's the main speakers, and RC3 2 black center channel, RF3 2 surround sound speakers in white, quote, better spousal acceptance factor, unquote, and an R12SW subwoofer. All in excellent condition with original packaging for safe transport or storage. They are too big for my new house. My wife is tired of them taking up space in the garage. I've put them up on Craigslist without much luck. Any help you can provide will be rewarded with half the sale price being donated to your show. Craig, you don't have to do that, but we like buying toys. He lives in Monterey, not too far from the Bay Area. Thanks for your great show, Craig.
90 minutes south.
Oh, my goodness. So a couple of good resources for selling audio. You know, Craigslist is awesome if you, especially if you live in the Bay Area, LA, New York City, but it is
got a good population density.
Yeah,
it makes it way easier to get responses to things.
Yeah, and the funny thing about Monterey is there's a fair number of people in Monterey, but it's a few hours from LA and it's a few hours from San Francisco. So one of the things I suggested is listing those speakers in the San Francisco Craigslist listings and the Los Angeles Craigslist listings, because that will take him from like a couple million people in the Monterey area to something in the neighborhood of 26 million people between LA and San Francisco. There are also some really good resources for selling audio gear that are much more audio focused than Craigslist, and I think a little less fraught than eBay. I love eBay. I hate eBay. It is what it is.
And
yeah.
I looked at eBay just to see what TV prices were for this week. Turns out, wow, they had the absolute lowest price yet I've seen on that LG OLED from last year, the B7,
right,
in the 55 and 65 inch. I think the 55 was like $1,100,
right,
and the 65 was like $1,500.
It's crazy.
Ridiculous. And it wasn't much more expensive via Amazon. So anyway, totally off topic.
No, it's all good.
That is a beautiful set of speakers. I hope Craig finds someone to buy that. Well, and I didn't realize you could post ads in different cities, even though you live somewhere else on Craigslist. That was something I wasn't aware of.
You know,
I'm not sure if there are limitations for any of that.
Certainly seen a lot of, you know, cars and electronics that are from far, far. I've seen people selling stuff in Denver posting in San Francisco. So there's certainly the ability to do it.
My buddy just sold his car on eBay. That was crazy. Anyway,
when it works, it's amazing. So a couple of resources for selling audio that are more audio focused in Craigslist. Audiogon.com is one of them, and you can get the scoop on how that works at audiogon.com/learn/selling.
AUDIOGON.
Yeah, and usaudiomart.com. And if you go to usaudiomart.com/FAQ.php, that gives you an idea of what's going on, how they work, what they charge you, if they charge you.
Considering how close he is to the San Francisco Bay Area, literally 90 minutes away, that's not such a trek. Yeah, you should be able to find somebody.
Yeah, I would certainly post them in San Francisco and then take a look at AudioGon and US Audio Mart. I would also say if you're searching for particular audio components, you know, eBay is always nice, but definitely keep an eye on, keep scanning US Audio Mart and AudioGon.com.
Coolio!
Speaking of bargain audio or bargain home theater gear or better prices on things, we got a great email from John. He says, hi guys, wanted to point the listener from episode 79 looking for an affordable AVR to accessories4less.com. accessoriesforless.com. They sell factory refurbished gear for 40 to 50% off MSRP, as well as affordable warranties to go with it if the 1 year isn't enough. I picked up a Denon X2300W for a great price and I love it. On an unrelated note, have either of you heard Chain's .4 series speakers? I've been on the list waiting for them to restock since January. Picked up a set of Fluence Signature RL plus C, our right, left, and center channel. And I'm wondering if it's worth the Chain's when they are finally available. Thanks, John.
I like that. Refurbished gear.
And I've bought a lot of factory refurbished computers.
As long as it has a warranty and somebody's actually tested it out, if it's truly... If the factory has gone through something, I'm good with that.
Yeah.
Maybe not so much on the display side of things, but for audio gear?
Audio gear can last a long time if it's not thoroughly abused. You know, just make sure they have a return policy in case it doesn't work. And if it's got a one-year warranty, that's an excellent start. Yeah, so John, thanks for the heads up on Accessories for Less. I've bought some gear from the clearance section of audioadvisor.com. That's actually where I bought my first set of planar magnetics. No, my second set of planar magnetics. There's another one I'm trying to remember that I'm sure I'll figure out before next week.
Chains.
I've never heard of them.
They're one of those brands I hear about in forums.
Okay.
I want to say right now they're doing
C-H-A-N-E.
Yeah, they're the chainmusiccinema.com is the website for that. You know, they had a great review on their A-Series speakers on CNET a few years ago. Right now, all of their stuff is out of stock, but they are taking pre-order. They're doing a group buy. The popular A1.4 returns in June with Chain's best group buy ever. That's like $340 a pair. You know, there's a waveguide and what looks like a leaf. They call it a leaf tweeter. You know, I hear good things about them all. I have not, okay, flat up, I have not heard them.
All right.
They have a lot of people who absolutely adore them on the forums. They're direct sale. They're U.S. designed, my understanding. They're made in China. Some people in the forums think that they basically tell China what they want in the loosest possible sense. And, you know, some people say that they go to a warehouse and somebody shows them a speaker and they buy a container load of them. I'm sure the truth lies somewhere in between. It's funny. This is one of the things, like, they have an excellent reputation on the forums. They're a good price. They're, you know, alternatives would include Elax, a debut line, or Unify line, Emotiva's T1 and T2. You know, we could go on talking about speaker options for a while because there's so many of them.
A little more difficult, it sounds like, to go somewhere and listen to these.
Yeah, so. they're sold factory direct. And that's one of the frustrating things about factory direct is that you often cannot hear them unless, like, your friend has them or you happen to be near the factory. But Shoe Audio is factory direct. The RSL sub, I mean, there's a long list of audio manufacturers that do fantastic gear. Those Fluences, I haven't heard either, but they look really nice. And, you know, I would say if you're happy with them, don't replace them. But if you are in that sort of like, yeah, I'm looking for something better, you know, if you have the space on your credit card and there's a return policy on the chains, buy the chains and see if you like them. If you don't like them, send them back. And that's kind of what's critical about buying mail order from companies you can't listen to locally. Can you return them if you don't like them?
Right.
You know, and there's a lot of companies that'll do that. They could be awesome. They could be awful. I have no idea, but I've heard things in forums, which is in many ways possibly the worst way to comment on a product. So I will apologize for that.
There you go.
We usually talk about what we're watching or listening. You're pissed at Major League Baseball.
Well, I would say it's mostly due to the blackout restrictions, which if you're a fan of their streaming services, you come to realize that local games are often blacked out for, you know, they always claim it's somebody else's fault or it's the agreement of the league with that team or whatever. I've come to deal with that in my own way. But recently, there were games where they weren't local teams. It was simply who was broadcasting it. And it sometimes will come down to an ESPN channel doing it. But recently, I've seen a couple games on Facebook. And it was like, wait, what is FB as the broadcaster? And I was like, wait a minute. I can only watch this on Facebook or or through their app or something? And it was, I'm telling you.
Rage!
These blackout restrictions are ridiculous. And I want them to go away. For sure. So,
oh my goodness.
Nah, it's a minor rant for my sports viewing, but
I watched Lady Hawk.
Oh!
On found it streaming on
I don't think I've seen that since the 80s.
Well, it came out in 85.
Okay.
It's the first time I ever saw Matthew Broderick in a film.
Yeah.
Rutger Hauer, Michelle Pfeiffer.
Ah. Rutger Hauer.
Rutger Hauer.
I always liked him.
We love Rutger Hauer.
Batty boy.
Who doesn't love Rutger Hauer?
Seriously.
If nothing else, Rutger Hauer, I will always treasure for those glorious, that last soliloquy he does in Blade Runner. Just a couple minutes of the best stuff ever captured on camera. Troopship's on fire.
Yeah, so, he also played the blind master martial artist or whatever. Some cheesy B-movie. Anyway.
He's done a lot of glorious stuff.
There is still,
it's crazy. He's got like three movies.
I've been just
coming out. Four movies coming out this year. And he's in
really?
A TV series. Channel
awesome.
Zero. So a shout out to Rutger Hauer.
Seriously.
Who's still out there working. But the reason I brought that up, it was interesting because, so Lady Hawk comes up. It's 1985. It was shot 4:3.
Oh, yeah.
It is, And it initially comes up, the way the titles are done, I thought it was letterboxing a 480p signal in the center of the screen. And then eventually the title sequence ends and I'm in 4:3 mode. And it was one of those moments where, you know, I understand this is not a cinematic classic and there's not a lot of money to be made off of, you know, nerds of a certain age, you know. But the subject of you know, wolves and swords and sorcery came up, so the kids were kind of curious about that.
Oh, cool.
But Captain Navarre and Philip Gaston. But it was funny because it was one of those moments where, because you've ruined my ability to watch movies without seeing any of a number of visual effects, it was one of those moments where boy, you talk about a film that could use a fresh Telecine and some new processing.
Just somebody go find that original 35mm.
Yeah, it was in, you know, a 4x3 movie.
Or whatever film stock it was.
Yeah. Well, a 4x3 movie can look fantastic on a 16x9 screen.
Certainly.
But
there are many classics.
You have to have a good transfer. And this is something I run into with kids' cartoons a lot, or cartoons that are as much for adults as kids, but claim to be children's cartoons. Hashtag Nickelodeon.
But you do need something that's at least taking up the full vertical resolution of the particular format you're using.
Yeah.
And it isn't being, you're not sacrificing, you know, the video pixels within the format to like black bars or crap like that. And further,
well, this was the full video format. It was just one of those moments where, you know, is that compression, film grain, or some really poorly applied filtering?
The VHS tape, and just transferred it to a DVD.
It was better than a VHS tape, but not by a lot. But, you know, it was, everything was there. You could resolve everything. But it was like listening to, you know, a tinny AM radio station where you're like, yeah, it's Hank Williams Sr., I think.
Yeah.
But it's unfortunate because
it may not have been mastered right either. They may have had the black level elevated or something.
Yeah.
Many content that old, like you said, that's not the precious.
Yeah.
That is not well transferred.
It almost makes me want to try to see where else I can find it and see if the transfers look the same. Because something I've noticed
I'd like to look at that on an OLED and see what the additional contrast performance can get out of that.
I don't think you want the additional contrast performance on this one. But it was interesting to think about. It wasn't a particularly expensive movie when it was made, right? You know, Rutger Hauer kind of... Don't hurt me, Rutger. Was kind of a classic B-movie actor at this point.
Totally.
You know, this was, as far as I know, Matthew Broderick's first film. He looks like he's 12. I mean, I think he's probably 25 and looks 16. But it was interesting. It reminds me of one of the things I heard about Buffy the Vampire Slayer, is because Fox had no money, so they got the cheapest film stock they could.
Ugh.
And when they went to, you know, when they've done transfers of that, they're like, wow, boy, it's a shame this turned into such a big hit, because this first season looks like ass every time we do a Telecine on it.
It's one thing if that content was stored properly, but what was it? Black Magic Designs. They do a lot of post-production and other video products and equipment that I've used for, you know, like a 3D lookup table box, or a variety of products out there. They just introduced a new film scanner that does automatic conversion of 35mm film to an HDR format.
Yeah.
And the person who mentioned this to me was like, you know, I've done a few film transfers, and I got to tell you, there's really nothing automatic about it. You almost want to look at every stupid frame and make sure everything is just the way it should be. While tools like the new Blackmagic film scanner are interesting, And hopefully it will encourage, you know, at least have an automated tool to go through maybe the content that will never receive the hand boutique style. Just, we're going to go through every frame and color correct and de-scratch and denoise and whatever. And for those types of content, I'm hoping that something easy comes up that they can at least convert this stuff into the whatever the best possible way we can currently archive things. So
apparently we need to do some sort of group funding so your favorite films from your youth will be restored at some marginal level.
I'm going to be going through basically garage sales looking for VHS tapes at some point, I'm sure. So
it's a thought. It was just, you know, watching Lady Hawk made me realize, it reminded me again of like cartoons or it's interesting to realize just how poorly transferred so much of online content is.
You bring that up too, and I hadn't watched Netflix in a few weeks. I realized I was just busy running around doing things, and I realized they have a lot of content that I had not seen before, and a lot of older content too. Now available.
They rotate a lot of stuff.
They do. And
they're spending so much on creating their own new content to drive additional subscribers worldwide or internationally. They are, I think, cherry picking the least expensive content they can find.
Fascinating assortment of stuff to look at. And I'd be curious to see how they're handling some of the older titles too.
It was interesting.
I know they do things like advanced color correction.
Yeah.
Scaling, of course, they're going to rescale it a couple different ways, but what was the source material they started with? So we'll take a look at that.
Oh my goodness. With that, ladies and gentlemen, if this is your first episode of AVXL, do us a favor, head over to AVXL.com, get all the links to subscribe and all the links to all of our older shows. And if you're a patron, thank you so much. And if you're not a patron, please head on over to patreon.com/AVXL and join the crew that makes the show possible. Ask at AVXL.com is where you can email us. And as we mentioned earlier, tweet at Robert Heron, at Patrick Norton, or at AVXL. And we got a new episode coming up fresh next week to celebrate the joys of June. I like that, the joys of June.
Yeah. People graduating.
Oh, my goodness.
Summer's almost here.
Our special graduation episode. I have no idea what we'll talk about. Email us and tell us what to talk about next week, and we'll talk about it.
Do it.
I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Robert Heron.
We'll catch you next week on AVXL.